Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
We welcome you to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Behind the Scenes. Coming up on today's show, we're going to discuss food sales numbers from the USDA. We'll also discuss potential shakeups in the office retail space, or at least rumored shakeups, that is. In our interview segment, we'll be discussing in-store robotics, particularly as they pertain to floor cleaning products, as well as shelf scanning technology. We call these things autonomous mobile robots. And we'll be joined by Josh Balin, the Senior Director of Strategy at Brain Corp, to discuss how they've developed, where there's been some false starts in retail as far as this has been concerned, where the technology is headed, and some of the developments that are in place such that customers, for lack of a better term, don't freak out when they see the robots in the stores. A quick reminder that you can like us and rate us on any podcast listening service. This is the obligatory reminder every show, but whatever service you use, your likes, your ratings help us move up the charts and they help others to find us. So if you do enjoy the podcast, help others to find this retail content. Additionally, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. I'm actually recording this episode of the podcast in Missoula, Montana, where some pictures will be posted on Instagram. We went to Hamilton, Montana, the site of one of 15 remaining Kmart stores. We also saw a lot of diversity in grocery retail in Missoula. And we'll talk about it on the show next week when Leighton rejoins the podcast. Now, as I mentioned, our news segment, we're going to lead off with office retail and specifically news from Office Depot. You know, it seems like every 2 to 3 years, we see a reshaping of the office supply space. Let's harken back to 2013. Office Depot acquired Office Max. They became one company. Now, a Bloomberg report this week suggests that this combined company may be spinning the one company, Office Depot, into two separate entities. And as I said, every couple of years, we get some sort of shakeup or proposed shakeup in this space. Beyond the original merger in 2013, the proposed takeover by Staples that was shot down by the FTC in 2015 of Office Depot. And then also you had Staples going private in 2017 and so forth. So this is a space where really, if you wanted to look back beyond 2013, if you wanted to look back to the 90s, we just spoke of Kmart, but Kmart used to be a majority shareholder in Office Max, and then they sold that, and they went through various iterations there. And so this is really a circumstance where you have these three companies, Office Depot, Office Max, and Staples. There's been a lot of movement, but it seems like every 2 to 3 years, we get a shift or a proposed shift that really makes the news. Now, let's talk about the details from this proposed spinoff. Office Depot, according to Bloomberg, would be split into two publicly traded companies. The company's Business Solutions Division and Regional Office Supply Distribution Functions would split from the retail division. So you'd have one division operating the stores, the other division primarily doing the B2B business that Office Depot features. Now, this makes some measure of sense, and there's also historical precedence for it. This is also what Sycamore Partners did when Staples was taken private in 2017. Only then they split Staples into essentially three operating divisions, three companies instead of two. Now, leadership for Office Depot has mentioned on previous earnings calls about the distinct operations of each division. And of course, we know what the retail version does. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably familiar with that. But the Business Solutions Division, they provide contract services to employers for things like office supplies, furniture, and the like. Pre-pandemic, this was the division that was seeing some sales success for the company as a whole, although sales understandably tailed back a bit during the pandemic as people not going into offices as much, therefore not necessitating as much in the way of office supplies or furniture. Conversely, you saw the retail division of the business pick up slightly as people were beginning to really shape their home office. So you were seeing sales of office furniture, sales of home office supplies, sales of scanners, printers, and the like. Still, when you look at 2020, at least the fiscal year, the Business Solutions Division brought in $4.7 billion in revenue. Retail sales, $4.2 billion. So Business Solutions, the B2B, does bring in a little bit more on the revenue front. And they would be, you would think, although it hasn't been said officially yet, they would be the slightly larger of the two companies in terms of market cap once they get split off into two publicly traded companies. That, by the way, if I haven't mentioned it already, it's that Business Solutions division that would be contained within the new company. So the traditional Office Depot company, as we know it, that would hold the retail stores. Now, the company hopes for this split to finish in the last two quarters of 2022. Essentially, this will occur as it typically does. Shareholders of Office Depot currently will receive shares of the new company as a tax-free dividend, again, according to Bloomberg. And so, in so doing, you reduce the share price of Office Depot, the retail company, going forward. Now, this all comes as there's an interesting backdrop here, because remember, Staples, and we didn't cover this on the podcast, but it was something that happened earlier in the year. Staples has shown renewed interest in acquiring Office Depot. Now, Staples, earlier in 2021, made an offer to Office Depot to purchase the company. Office Depot shot that down because of the unlikelihood that it would pass FTC muster. And this is important to note because not much has changed in the overall office supply retail landscape since 2017. You could make an argument that perhaps retail market share has been picked up by the likes of Walmart and Amazon, but the overall revenue brought in by Office Depot and by Staples, rumored revenue at least for Staples, considering they're private, we don't get their numbers, but it hasn't really substantially decreased. It's decreased some, but it hasn't substantially taken a hit. So Office Depot leadership kind of look back at 2015 as a case study here. Rather than fork over the massive amount of money needed to pay for attorney assistance with the FTC, only to see a deal potentially fail, they politely declined. And as Layton is fond of saying, of course, had they accepted, the only long-term winners would have likely been the lawyers collecting fees, regardless of the FTC ruling. Remember, anytime something like this happens in business, the real winners are always the attorneys. But this is important to note. Office Depot leadership said they might be open to reformulating the proposed deal with Staples in some way, shape, or form, which brings us to this news of a potential company split. When you step back to a high level, not hard to see where this may be going. Assuming the split in Office Depot takes place as expected, one could very easily see a possibility where one of the split companies is sold to Staples, the other remains independent. That leaves a more valid argument to the FTC. So if you sell off, for example, the contract division, the business solutions division to Staples, or if that company elects to sell itself to Staples, you can make the FTC argument that, hey, there are a lot of operators in this space. Likewise, you could potentially do so for the retail firms as well. FTC probably wouldn't sign off on the whole of the company as it currently stands going to Staples. So you wonder if this is maybe to position one of the Office Depot divisions to perhaps be in a better position to sell to Staples when this is all concluded in 2022, or more accurately put, maybe sell one of the companies or one of the new companies to Sycamore Partners, the current operator of Staples. So some interesting news, and be anxious to see where this will head. It's going to be a slow process. We know, obviously, the split of companies isn't going to take place until the first two quarters of 2022, so we have a little while to wait to see exactly how all this plays out. Well, we'll take a break, but coming back after this break, we'll be joined by Josh Balin, the Senior Director of Strategy at Brain Corporation. Brain Corp, once again, leader in software development for autonomous mobile robots. We're going to talk about floor cleaning technology as well as shelf scanning technology, developments in those spaces where development might be going, and why some retailers might have taken a step back in their robotics program before taking two steps forward as we hit the middle of 2021. The adoption of robotics by retailers has been on a steady upward trajectory over the last 5 years, and while use of robotics at distribution centers and fulfillment centers have been generally smooth in terms of that upward trajectory, we've seen robotics kind of grow by fits and starts in customer-facing areas of the store, but that is certainly accelerating now that the technology has caught up to the robots themselves, and here to discuss recent developments in robotics technology, particularly as it pertains to front store dynamics, we're joined by Josh Balin, the Senior Director of Strategy at Brain Corporation. Brain Corp is a leader in software development for autonomous mobile robots, or what you'll hear referred to as AMRs, across multiple industries. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, I gave a brief introduction, but I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the scope of Brain Corporation's work and then your role there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Brain Corp, as you mentioned, powers one of the largest fleet of autonomous mobile robots in the world. At the beginning of May, we had almost 15,000 robots that were powered by BrainOS, which is our cloud OS that allows each and every AMR on our network to communicate and get better actually with each and every run. We're in large retailers such as Walmart and Kroger, and we're in airports and malls all over the world. Our robots are in the United States and Europe, Japan, and a number of other locations. And, you know, overall, we're fairly happy to work with our partners and roll out our robots worldwide. In my role at the company, I lead strategy and analytics. And so that ranges from everything from external facing strategy, along with our manufacturing partners and software partners, to, of course, our customers, and internal strategy and analytics. And ultimately, we're just trying to allow our customers and our customers' customers to get the highest and best use out of our robots and our partners' robots.
So I want to zoom out just a little bit. Curious, from someone that works with this on the day-to-day, what has the development path looked like for robotics and retail since Brain Corporation was founded back in 2009? What have we seen really develop over that last 12 years?
Well, I mean, certainly you've seen some huge advances in the equipment itself, right? All the sensors and compute have gotten smaller and less expensive. The robots, or the machines rather, that are navigating around in retail environments have gotten more nimble. They've certainly learned to navigate better. In the case of Brain Corp, what's been, I think, super exciting is that where you may have had what I think is often referred to as a single purpose robot, right? A robot that in our case goes around and cleans floors. You're actually now able to start layering on multifunctionality on top of a single platform, right? And so, you know, we like to think about it for our customers in terms of, you know, we're actually enabling the robot to walk and chew gum. And we've seen our customers and our customers' customers really derive some serious value out of that. You know, and I want to go back to your introduction, Trent. You know, without question, there have been some fits and starts in the industry. And I think one of the advantages that we've had in being around for so long is that, you know, our robots have, frankly, they've operated, I want to say at this point, over 5 million autonomous hours. And we've covered over 70 billion square feet of space, right, since our robots were deployed. And so when you have a fleet of our size and you have that amount of coverage and space that we're looking at, what we're really able to do is start to solve those edge cases of navigation inside these complex environments, right? I think when you look at the last year in particular, and you know, you've mentioned this on some prior podcasts, but obviously the pandemic changed retail environments quite significantly in a very short period of time. And I think Brain, you know, by virtue of being a leader in some of our coverage, has been able to, you know, sort of be at the forefront of solving some of those edge cases in these highly complex environments.
I wanted to ask you one more general question before we get into some specific uses of AMRs here, but I think there's been kind of an ongoing conversation about the role of robotics and retail, really any kind of technology. I remember I was at Kmart when self-checkouts rolled out in the late 90s, and there was a big to-do about, oh, well, is it replacing jobs? How are the associates going to interact with the technology, et cetera? And I'm just kind of curious, from Brain Corp's perspective, what's the optimal role? What do you see as the optimal role for robotics technology as far as retail is concerned?
Well, I mean, you know, without question, robots, and specifically our robots, are going to fulfill a role that certain workers have done in the past. Where I think we and other robotics makers that are particularly in retail have, I think, been fairly acute at understanding, you know, some of the intricacies of these environments and some of the people that operate this, is that our robots really can't succeed without collaboration with the workers that are in these environments. Right? I'm sure you've heard in some cases, some people refer to things as cobots or whatever, but we do really believe that at the core, the folks who are operating our robot are actually a very valuable piece in our ecosystem. And everybody up from store managers to HQ should be understanding how the robots operate. And when they're operating at their best, these workers can actually, you know, be freed up to do some different things in the store, right? Whether that's additional customer service or even additional sanitation, right? You know, again, during COVID, you saw plexiglass going up at registers. You saw additional cleansing and sanitization happening in high touch areas like freezer handles and things like that. And every hour spent riding a manual floor scrubber is an hour not spent with those higher value cleaning use cases, right? And so we absolutely believe that the people that are operating the stores are a huge component of making our robots a very valuable component in their sort of overall store operations story. And we'll continue to sort of look for value out of those folks.
You mentioned in your response, obviously, floor care, a big use of AMRs, probably the most frequent use of AMRs I've seen to this point. So I wanted to focus on the floor cleaners, so to speak. How does this technology work on a high level? And what were some of the considerations that went into developing that technology for the retail sales floor as far as floor care is concerned?
This is, I think, where we've got a very unique advantage just in terms of our particular business model. So as I think you know, Brain actually develops software and AI around sort of the navigation and object detection and navigation within these environments. But we've partnered with the leading manual machine makers in the world for commercial floor care, right? So when you hear names like Tennant and Nilfisk, Karcher, Hakko, these are our partners. And these folks know commercial floor care better than anybody, right? And they've got extremely extensive service networks, and they've got customers that are very familiar with their floor care offerings. And so for us, by partnering with leading machine makers who know this stuff, you know, better than we ever could out of the gate, we've really been able to capture a lot of the, I won't quite say tribal knowledge, but some of the intricate retail knowledge that these vendors had, right? And so things like pad pressure and different floor types and aisle width and all of these variables go into exactly how clean the store is going to get based on the usage of AMRs. Without question, there's more to come in terms of innovation around edge cleaning and potential additional sanitization features, right? Whether you're talking about UV light or extra sprays. But again, there's a tremendous amount of innovation around just keeping a store clean. And I think, again, by having excellent partners, we've really been able to, you know, ride on their, in some cases, 100 plus years of experience in cleaning floors.
So you talk about, of course, some of the things that go into the development of not only the robots themselves, but also that technology that runs it. I want to look at some of the analytic categories as well. There's a really interesting post. In fact, if you go out to Brain Corp's website on their Robot Central blog, the latest blog post is about measurables regarding the cleaning success of floor scrubbers. And I'm curious, what kind of KPIs are out there to where you've got these measurables in terms of how you can determine what kind of a job is being done by these scrubbers?
Yeah, this is a great question. So when you think about it, right, let's build up sort of the atomic unit of what we're measuring, right? Robots run routes. Routes cover some portion of a store. That store has some amount of square footage, and it takes some duration of time to actually go ahead and run that route and cover that square footage, right? And so ultimately, what we're measuring is we want to see how much was cleaned, at what efficiency, in what areas, and ultimately, right, if a particular area wasn't cleaned, why not? And what's so, I think, value add about our solution is that whether it's a store manager or it's HQ for a particular retailer, they can pull up last night's activity like they probably couldn't with a manual floor scrubber and actually see, oh, the robot, you know, it ran the produce section and the freezer section and it ran, you know, aisles 7 through 12, but it didn't get these other couple of sections on the side of the store. Why? Well, they were restocking at 2 in the morning. Okay, great. All right. At least I know kind of where I stand. And so I think that this idea of measurable clean is sort of the new table stakes for a lot of what we do. and sort of developing these standards of information about what's going into the store and what goes into a store's cleaning plan is something that is slowly getting adopted sort of globally. But by our customers, it's certainly something that's been a switch in their view, where going from zero to one has really been a game changer in terms of, you know, that measurable clean.
I want to move from the cleaning of the floors to shelf scanning technology. I think this is probably a topic that's gotten the most press, maybe, of any robotics development in retail over the last 5 years. We know, of course, Walmart rolled back an earlier robotics partnership. Again, not your company. I'm not going to ask you to speak to that particular thing as you're in Walmart now. But it also speaks to the delicate balance you have to strike to get this type of thing right, especially as far as shelf scanning technology is concerned. So what are, as you're developing this, some pitfalls maybe to avoid as far as this particular technology goes? And what advances have been made in shelf scanning technology over maybe the last 12 months or so?
Yeah. So, you know, without question, capturing data about shelves it's a valuable piece of data that the retailers are sort of looking to learn more about the capabilities and sort of learn more about how that functionality is going to fit into, you know, some of their workflows, right? Because ultimately it's about having healthy shelves and, you know, happy customers. What I would say in terms of pitfalls, I mean, number one, you're dealing with a lot of data, right? And so if the objective is to have a robot rove around in a particular environment and constantly either be taking pictures or video and processing AI or computer vision on that stuff, you've got to be very sensitive still to bandwidth and compute. These are real constraints. But I think beyond some of those technical constraints, I think at the core, it's really figuring out, and this is, again, why we're so lucky to work with great partners and great customers, it's figuring out the use cases that are most valuable to the retailers that are trying to roll out these solutions. When it comes to shelf scanning broadly, obviously Bossa Nova kind of has its single purpose approach, right? A very, you know, many cameras, many as arrays of cameras and lights. And there's other approaches like a Trax as an on-shelf camera that does some of the intelligence in sort of some of these high volume areas. And I think it's about, you know, again, working with customers to determine the use cases they're going to add the business value, you know, that's desired, right? Just as an example, for a high volume, let's say a pharmacy area, a robot that goes through there once a day may not be enough fidelity, right, or enough frequency to give shelf conditions or on-shelf product availability insights sort of at the level that a retailer needs that's going to add value, right? And so it's possible that our solution or other robotic solutions aren't the best solution for that particular business use case, where shelf cameras and sort of more full-time monitoring may be. However, when you start to get into, okay, the robot's going to run once a day and it's going to localize every product in your store, and we're going to be able to map every single product in your store in real time, these are really game changers for store managers. You know, again, I was listening to one of your earlier podcasts, and I am sure you have store managers out there that print up a CAD file at the beginning of the day and are either attaching sticky notes to them or highlighters and drawing out maps by hand. And a lot of that workflow can be automated, and that's something that we're doing. With regards to advances over the last 12 months, you know, what I would say, and I think this is a novel approach to the direction that we've taken, is that because we enlist third-party AI vendors to help us and to help our customers drive insights, we're actually able to derive multiple insights off of a single, you know, image or a single video, right? Where one AI provider may be particularly good at identifying, you know, a box of Cheerios, for example, whereas another one may be quite good at spill detection. And the way that our system is architected is that we'll actually let multiple AI vendors have a look at that same data and derive, you know, the insights that our customers are looking for. And so I think, you know, the more flexible that shelf scanning technology can be to shifting demands of customers and to alternative use cases and really leveraging, you know, the increasing value of some computer vision and tech that's out there, I think those have really been the primary ways that things have changed over the last 12 months.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of the shelf scanners, at least to me, is the way they evaluate compliance with a retailer's planogram for particular areas of the store. I think There are numbers floating around. Planogram compliance usually pretty poor, around 40 to 60%. So from a high level, as far as the shelf scanning technology is concerned, as far as these robotics technologies are concerned, how does this work to kind of make sure that retailers' planograms that are produced by corporate or whoever are getting followed on the store level?
Yeah, and I think it goes back to one of the things that we're quite adept at, which is this concept of localizing images and localizing products within an environment, right? And what that allows you to do is that allows you to build, again, a little kitschy, but a realogram, right? What are the actual conditions of my shelves? And so measuring now the differential between, you know, that realogram and sort of the intended planogram becomes a lot easier when you've got real-time conditions. In addition to what I think you're calling shelf scanning, you know, one of the other things that we're actually rolling out right now with some limited partners is this concept of virtual store visits, right? And I think as travel declined during COVID, there became this great need for HQ to actually get out into the stores because that's what they're used to doing and actually kind of look at the conditions in these stores. And so we're actually working on virtual store visits with our partners that enable, you know, executives who are these days sitting at home, but, you know, sitting at HQ to actually go walk around a store just the same way that you would walk around a house tour on Zillow. And so this has been a way to kind of close that gap between planogram and realogram. And I think, you know, as these types of technologies become more and more mature, I think this is how, you know, we'll ultimately be able to kind of live out our vision of, you know, automating the aisle for these retailers, right? And so I think there's some components of sort of detailed shelf scanning, detailed computer vision and differentials between sort of intended planogram and a realogram. But more importantly, I think these virtual store visits are going to really unlock some value and allow the retailer and potentially some of their brands or customers to have a real-time look, real-time annotation tools and ways to really communicate with store managers about shelf conditions and end cap setups and features and holidays and all these things are coming. And we know that, you know, within these dynamic environments, there's always shifting needs, but getting boots on the ground inside the store is the best way ultimately to kind of close those gaps.
Love that concept of virtual store visits. Certainly cuts down on a lot of travel downtime for the DMs and RMs once that gets going. Now, I did want to mention something a little bit fun in terms of the actual design of these robots. I know from talking to a few people at conferences back when conferences were a thing, that a focus goes into making them look as friendly, so to speak, as possible, not only in terms of outside design, but also in terms of movement as well. In terms of this aspect of the robots themselves, how much of that structure is function and how much is it just trying to create kind of a friendly look, friendly movement pattern so as to reduce any potential alarm on the part of customers, knowing full well, of course, that you develop primarily the technology behind the robots?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you're bringing up is a huge focus for us. And it's something that, you know, where our work is really never done. When you're talking about kind of the behavior or the design of these robots, this is something where, you know, changes that we make, even from a software perspective, have real life implications, right? So, you know, our robots may be a little bit different from some purpose-built robots, because again, because our robots are actually produced by our partners, in a lot of cases, they're actually taking machines that have existed in these environments and effectively outfitting it with a hardware kit, right, which is some LIDARs and sensors and some compute and our software. And that effectively turns that manual machine into an autonomous machine. And we actually leverage a method of training routes, which is called teach and repeat. Right. And so we leverage the cleaning staff sort of knowledge about, let's say, the best way to clean a particular store. And we just tell them, hey, put it in training mode, drive around the store like you normally would to clean the store. And the robot effectively remembers that route, right? So that's the teach and repeat methodology. When you get into kind of how our robot actually works inside of these environments, you know, number one, safety is, of course, sort of the top priority, right? And so if people are moving in front of it, it stops. If, you know, restockers are moving pallets or, you know, a ladder falls or something, it stops. And it can completely be restarted. But I think to your point, you know, we're very conscious that I'll give you a concrete example. We rolled out a feature where our robots got a bit faster, and we thought this was great. And what we realized in some cases, when we actually saw the robots in real time, and when you look at sort of how different people that are passing the robot sort of react to it, some cases it was almost a bit too fast, right? Even though we're confident that that robot is as safe as can be, the customer kind of is walking by being like, wow, that thing seems a little assertive to me. And so we actually needed to dial it back just a little bit, just to make sure that it was in line with folks' expectations about how this was going to work, right? And so I think your point is spot on. And, you know, there's definitely sort of an effort, you know, an anthropological effort to sort of humanize robots, right? Badger had Marty, sometimes they put eyes on them and things like that. You know, different customers have different ideas about this, but without question, the biggest, you know, concern, and I think you hit it spot on, is really how people respond to the different types of innovations that we're working on. And, you know, again, it's, we've got a whole team of folks that are dedicated to this type of behavioral research and design, and it's something that we take really seriously.
Well, that's fantastic insight. I want to finish up here, though, in terms of looking to the future without giving away any company secrets or anything along those lines. What's kind of the future for in-store robotics as far as retail is concerned?
Well, I think the future is that, number one, you're going to see a lot more retailers continue to move that direction, right? And I think, you know, you're aware of this, but, you know, we did a Retail Wire survey that came out that said, you know, about two-thirds of retailers are putting budget in place, getting a strategy in place right now if they're not already doing it. Almost 80%, in fact, of large retailers are sort of moving this direction, right? And so you'll continue to see broader adoption of robotics in these environments, especially as form factors get more and more environmentally friendly, in the sense that, like, you know, some of our scrubbers were 28 inches or 30 inches wide. I mean, we now even have some scrubbers that are 36 inches wide for some industrial and commercial warehouse environments. But as they get smaller, I think you'll see more and more of them. As you start to see innovation around automatic charging and docking and refilling, right? Some of the maintenance work around the robots, improved communications from the robots to the staff, integrations. Again, I was listening to one of your earlier podcasts where you're talking about the POS, but you can imagine robots getting integrated with handhelds that different retailers use, right? Whether it's a Zebra or something like that. And so deeper and deeper integration of the robotics solution with existing workflows, smaller form factors, increasing automation around some of the more menial tasks of the robots themselves, right? These are still machines. They do still require, you know, some level of TLC. I think all of those are where you could see innovation. And obviously, I think that this concept of multifunction robots is very real, right? And so, you know, without speculating, like when you do look at some other robotics vendors, they've got a single platform, it's totally verticalized, it does a very specific thing. And in our case, by having different partners and different applications, right, whether it's cleaning or material handling or different types of data collection and insights, having a flexible platform is going to be something that I think is going to be very valuable going forward, because the desire to bolt on more and more functionality over time is sort of ever increasing.
Just fantastically interesting stuff. We love talking about this type of thing as it pertains to brick and mortar retail. Once again, Josh Balin, the Senior Director of Strategy at Brain Corp. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
As I mentioned during that interview, and by the way, we thank Josh for joining us, but if you go to Brain Corp's website, it's just braincorp.com. You can click on Robot Central, and that's their blog, if you want to keep up on some of the interesting goings-on in this space. And also, you can look at some of those key performance indicators, those KPIs that Josh talked about during the interview that measure the efficacy of these floor cleaning robots and of the shelf scanning robots as well. It is some quite interesting information, so if this is a topic that interests you, I highly recommend checking that out. It is certainly something that I have taken steps to bookmark, because I'll be checking in to see where that technology is headed. I think the information there is going to be a lot more in-depth than you'll see in some of those online news articles, certainly, that talk about robotics technology being adopted by retail firms. Now it's time for our Looking Ahead segment, and I am looking ahead ultimately at 2021 food sales, and I'm doing so through the lens of numbers released this week by the U.S. Department of Agriculture regarding 2020 spending on food. Now, spending on food last year was a little bit different, obviously, than 2019 with the pandemic. We knew spending at restaurants would be down. We just didn't know by how much in aggregate. USDA numbers now show that total food spending dropped 18.3% at restaurants, cafeterias, and other places where you could go and pick up basically a remotely prepared meal. Now, that was a pretty substantial decrease, and in fact, it led to an overall decrease in food spending, but food at home spending, the type that usually takes place through grocers and other retailers, the type that we talk about here on the show, that increased by 8.5%. So obviously important to note, overall, 2020 U.S. spending on food dropped about 5.3%, or about $90 billion when looked at in the aggregate. The only other time in the last 25 years that spending has decreased in the course of a year over the prior year was, in fact, the Great Recession. So the reason I'm looking ahead to 2021 is this. We know that there will be some bounce back in restaurant spending. The real question, and this is something that we really don't know the answer to in the retail space just yet, is how will that impact grocery retailers? Will we see people continue to prepare food at home now that they're in the habit of doing so? Will people automatically and very quickly revert back to their restaurant habits of 2019, or will it take some time? Have grocery stores effectively captured some of this food spending market share from restaurants, and to what extent? These are questions that we can't answer just yet. I feel like the 2021 iteration of these numbers will paint a little bit better of a picture, but also overall food spending in the U.S., will you see it go up? Well, of course, if you spend money on food at a restaurant, I don't have to tell anyone listening to this podcast this, but it's going to cost more money ultimately, and so you can get by a little bit more cheaply if you buy groceries at the store, generally speaking, of course. But here's the thing. You also have the specter of inflation on the horizon. Inflation is something that has been mentioned repeatedly, especially over the last couple of months, and especially in the grocery space. So if you see overall spending on food increase, how much of that is due to inflationary pressures? How much of that is due to people returning to restaurants? And what does that mix look like? More importantly, what impact does it have on retailers who, remember, scaled a lot of operations up during the pandemic, including increasing hiring? How does any loss in market share affect staffing at these stores as well? So all of these things going to be answered really in the next couple of quarters by grocers as, again, you see vaccines continue to be rolled out. Now you've got pretty much anyone that wants a vaccine has access to it. So it'll be interesting to check on the grocery space in the months ahead. Well, that'll do it for this week's edition of the podcast. We'll cut it short so I don't annoy everyone else in my hotel by recording here. But big thanks to Leighton behind the scenes and running our social media. I'm Trent saying so long until next week, and have a great next 7 days.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.